Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Gallen. And joining me in studio right now is candidate for Congress for the 1st Congressional District, Jerry Cannon. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having us, Rick.
Appreciate you coming up to the UP. I know that the 1st Congressional District is huge. It's a lot of places to visit when you're trying to canvass.
Absolutely. 32 counties. I'm told it's the second largest district east of the Mississippi as far as geography. It's a long drive, but it's certainly a beautiful area. It's one of the probably most beautiful parts of the country. That's why so many people come here for vacations and what have you. So, matter of fact, we were up here last summer. I brought the whole family up. We were up in Keweenaw. We stayed at the Keweenaw Mountain Lodge, rented 5 cabins up by Copper Harbor. And I told the kids, you might as well leave your phone home, your computer home. Nothing's going to work up here. We're just going to do some family stuff. So it's a beautiful area.
Now, this is kind of an opportunity for me to get to know you, because during the last election cycle, I was working here but not doing this particular program. So it's a good opportunity for me. So let's start with there. Tell me a little bit about yourself and where you're from.
Well, my name is Jerry Cannon. I'm married to my wife, Liz. We were high school sweethearts, so I went to high school together, and we've been married 46 years. We're originally from southeast Michigan, down by Detroit. I was born in Detroit. I went to school in River Rouge, which is a suburb, one of the inner tier suburbs of the Detroit area. We have 4 adult children, 8 grandchildren. We're hoping for a few more. You know, we got one son that's just recently married, so we're hoping he'll add to the clan over time. I've had 2 great careers in one lifetime. I started out in law enforcement with the River Rouge Police Department, down where I went to school. And I stayed there for 7 years, and I moved to Kalkaska in 1977 to be their detective. And I stayed at the Sheriff's Department and sort of climbed the ranks, you know, and I ended up being the sheriff. I was a sheriff from 1987 through 2004. So I was the longest serving sheriff in Kalkaska's history at 18 years consecutive. I finished my boss's term, and I had 4 elections of my own. I have a bachelor's degree from University of Detroit in criminal justice, a master's degree from Central Michigan University in public administration. And my other career, I simultaneously served in the Michigan Army National Guard. And originally I was assigned at Camp Grilling, which is in Kalkaska County. And so in my military career, I was very successful, and I had the opportunity to go to the Army War College, where I got a master's degree in strategic study. And so I ended up, I started out in the Marine Corps. 2 weeks out of high school, I was in Marine Corps boot camp. 20 weeks out of high school, I was in Vietnam. And about 20 months out of high school, I was back in my neighborhood on leave from Vietnam. And I finished up my Marine Corps enlisted as a sergeant down at Camp Lejeune. And when I moved up north, the sheriff that I worked for, Al Hart, says, you know, they were looking for Vietnam. After the war, they sort of hollowed out the force, and they realized that they got rid of too many people. And so he said, they're looking for Vietnam vets to go to officer candidate school. And we both agreed to go, and we went together. And I got my commission. I was probably the oldest second lieutenant in the Army. And I ended up being a major general and served all over the world on short deployments, but about 2.5 years in Iraq, one doing police training for the Iraqi Ministry of Interior, and then I was the Provost Marshal General in Iraq during the drawdown for detainee operations and all the military police operations. And then I retired in 2012, and I'm very involved in my local community, Fife Lake, Kalkaska County, and served on the hospital board, the school board, just, you know, any myriad of opportunities to serve in the community. And that's sort of my makeup. I'm really one about adding and contributing to the value of the community, and not just be a person that sort of takes away. So we've been deeply involved. All our children went to Kalkaska Public Schools, all graduated, all are very successful in their own right. They're all have attended college. My daughter is in education. My son's in medical services. Second boy, our third child, graduated from Michigan Tech here. He's an engineer. And then our third son went to Alpena Community College, and he's his degree is in electrical. Well, it'll be like a lineman or something. But He's doing heavy equipment operation for the state of Michigan, so he's the guy that wanted to be outside.
Well, I appreciate your service. Yep. Thank you so much for that. Now you've got your eyes set on this congressional seat, and you know, with so much already accomplished, it sounds like there's more that you want to do. So let's talk about those things that are important for you that you want to be able to accomplish if you were able to win the seat.
Well, I think the first thing, Rick, is I think we want to have a candidate that you know, I ran for this seat last cycle, midterm, against Dr. Benishek. And it was really an eye-opening experience. Got to meet a lot of wonderful people throughout the district. And so for me, the concern is that I think our Congress is pretty ineffective. So much dysfunction and so much unwillingness to work together and find the common ground and pragmatically solve problems and take care of the people. And so for me, I think we need to have someone that's just going to say, you know, we got to do better than this. You know, this is a great disservice to everybody. And so for me, I think we want to have a congressman that is, one, willing to listen to the people and anticipate problems and try to do some things to prevent problems from festering and creating a burden for the people that live in the district. And then I think if a problem does arise, I think you got to act. And my whole career has been about action, results, and accountability. I mean, that's, you know, I'm a problem solver. I get things done. And, you know, so for me, I think you got to have those things as in the makeup of your candidate. And I think the other thing is that you want to have someone that's not only willing to listen, but will put the health, safety, and welfare of the constituents, the people of the district, first and foremost. And then I think we need to have someone that's going to be, you know, embrace innovation. I think that's going to be the future. I mean, part of the issue for us is, you know, how do we fight all these problems that we have? And a lot of it is just about, if you want to fight poverty, we got to get employment. We got to figure out how we're going to get jobs. And so I think you got to embrace innovation. And I think you got to, and a lot of opportunities that can come from innovation. I'll give you one quick example. My son-in-law went to Lake Superior. Got a great degree in electrical engineering, went to work for General Electric, has had a great career. And I often ask him, I says, don't you think you could have just stayed here? I mean, you got this great state education, but you took it to General Electric, which is a great company. And I says, I know there's some ideas that if we could have kept you here, you could have developed them, we could have figured. So I know here we have smart zones and people to help, you know, be incubators of innovation. But I think if we could solve some of the employment issues, it would help solve the poverty and then the things that sort of echo from that. So a lot of opportunities come from that innovation. But I think we need to have an economy that works for everybody. I think we got to have an education system that feeds into this innovation idea, but never at the expense of the environment. So I think you got to have that as a background. So you got to have this willingness to serve and this the idea that, you know, you can make a difference. Some people say, like, what do you think you're going to do? You're just going to be one guy. And I said, but I can be the squeaky wheel. And I've been in some pretty tough spots around the world. And I've served on boards at the local level all the way up to the international level. And I've been able to work with people who have, I mean, generations, thousands of years of disagreement, you know, religious and political and ethnic differences, and I'm able to get people to work together. So I think that sets me up for success working with Congress. I can find some common ground that we can all agree on to advance an issue. And I've done that at the local level, and I've done that all the way up to the international level. So I've had these wonderful opportunities and experiences, and I think I'd like to take them to Washington and try to make a difference in improving the lives of the people here. The hero of the story is not the candidate. It's about the things that we get to do to help improve the lives of people who live here. You know, we have, you know, there are people struggling in places that are struggling, and we got to have someone like, you know, what's going on in rural America? Everything is focused in the urban areas. Well, what about us? You know, what's going on here? Are we always going to be an afterthought because we just don't have a lot of people? I think we can do something about that. You got to have someone that's willing to pick up the mantle of responsibility and champion that cause.
I'm going to stick with the environment a little bit because of the Great Lakes and how important they are to not only us, but to the entire economy of the Great Lakes states and throughout the country. There have been more and more reports of other outside entities looking to tap into the Great Lakes for their own purposes. We've got, you know, other cities that are now pumping water out of the Great Lakes. We need to protect its resources. How would you propose we do that?
Well, we have that Great Lakes Compact already. So if you don't live in that water basin for the Great Lakes, you can't take water out. I know down in Wisconsin there's a big issue going on there. And, there's other ways that they could solve that problem. But the easiest, well, we just want to draw directly. Well, why don't you just work with Milwaukee or something? Why don't you work out some kind of other deal? We need to protect, that resource. It's phenomenal. It's certainly the economic engine of northern Michigan for sure, with, tourism and the fisheries and shipping. And so the lakes are up. Like a foot, I'm told. And so some people say, well, you got more than you need. And we're going to take that water and we're going to send it to the Southwest and we're going to grow food and we're going to bring that back. No. Let's figure out another way. We need to protect it, not just from withdrawal, but from pollution and all those other invasive species and Asian carp and all those kinds of things would have a dramatic impact on the economy of northern Michigan.
Our biggest export is our children. That's what is said around town, that whether they're graduating from Michigan Tech or local high schools, they can't wait to get away. I think that the tide's turned a little bit in the last few years because there are some job opportunities, but certainly not enough. And it always seems like this would be a perfect place to begin an industry, whether it's, high tech is big and we've got the resources for it. What would you do to encourage those jobs, good paying jobs, not just minimum wage jobs, but good paying jobs with futures, with companies that can grow, to open up here or relocate here?
Well, there's an amazing thing. You gave the example of my son-in-law. I worked for General Electric. He can do his job from anywhere as long as he has connectivity to the internet. And so he's dealing with issues all the way around the world as long as he gets to work out of his house. And in the summer when the kids get out of school, they come up to in our area down by Fife Lake, and they have a cottage on the lake, and they're there all summer. And so to encourage people, I think you got to have the willingness to, first of all, I think we got to play to our strengths. So we have a lot of natural beauty, and that appeals to a lot of people. When we talk about innovation, if we can hold on to these young people and help them, not everybody's going to be the innovator, but they certainly need some good jobs. And if we have someone that's an innovator and they create these economic opportunities, we should help them. We should help them, and then when they are successful, hey, stay here, start manufacturing here, hire people from here, do more internships with students that are, we got three great state universities all here in the Upper Peninsula. But to reach out to others, we got to play to our strength, and obviously we've got great natural resources, and we need to find a way to bring those forces to bear. We got a great workforce. And so the biggest issue is transportation. How are we going to get that stuff in here or out of here to make those kinds of things happen? And so looking at what I say is the economic engine of northern Michigan, I don't think we're going to get an Air Force base back. I don't think we're going to get a GM plant or any. There's no silver bullet. There's no solution. There's no one answer that's going to solve all these problems. But I think the economic engine of northern Michigan is our small businesses. So working with them on incentives, they already know. They know what's holding them back. And it's probably unique to every business. But probably the biggest thing that's holding us back is there's not enough sustainable year-round jobs for people to buy things, to do things. And we need to try to figure that out. And so working with them, I think the local businesses know what can be done, what could be done. As far as wood products and mining and all the things related to the natural resources, there's experts out there that have an idea. We need to work with them if it's going to take some incentives to get them here. But the natural resources are here, so if they want them, they got to come here. We need to make sure that we do these things in a way that doesn't harm the environment. And so it's again, there's no silver bullet to solving all these problems, but I tell you, if we can put people to work with sustainable year-round jobs with a living wage, they'll spend that money here. There's a spin-off effect to all of that. That solves the poverty. If we solve poverty, it solves all kinds of other problems with education and all those related issues. And so I think probably a key ingredient is, let's solve the problem of poverty in our district. And we don't have the luxury in urban areas. Certainly there's poverty, without a doubt. Maybe even abstract poverty. But they're also in proximity to a lot of network of services to help. we are kind of isolated. I mean, these communities are few and far between and far apart. And I read a headline, it wasn't a headline, but it was on the front page of a local paper down in Traverse City. And it was a student, and I understand there will always be kids that want to leave their hometown and go out and, you know, see the world. And the quote was, I don't want to get trapped in Traverse City, and, you know, I want to go out and do something. I was like, my God, this is such a beautiful place. And a lot of people do want to leave, and I think over time, if they have the ability, want to come back. And they got to figure out whatever it is that they've learned to do in that intervening 10 years, how can I do that back here? And a lot of times, if you've got the connectivity, you can do almost anything from anywhere. And I'll tell you, an interesting thing is, you know, the federal government, we had a lot of Air Force bases up here in days gone by. And so the fact that Washington, D.C. is like all the government jobs need to be in Washington, D.C., that's not true. Now that you've got this ability to use the internet to get things done, it's like we could... You know, we could bring some of these jobs back here. It might be just small potatoes compared to an Air Force base, for example. But everything helps. And how do you make that happen? You know, are we a donor state where we pay more money into the federal government than we get back? Well, then we need to turn that around. And so why is the South such a big player in our military, for example? Well, you know, they had congressmen and senators who were like... made themselves visibly present and verbally known about, you know, what they needed to have in their district. We need to have someone standing up, fighting for us, speaking up for us, you know, sticking up for us. And we are a rural area. I think we're an afterthought. I think, and it's not just our area. I think there's a whole part of the country of rural America that I think new congressmen ought to create, if it doesn't already exist, a rural caucus to stand up, you know, for the things that we need here. And so... I think there's a lot of opportunities to do some different things, to network. I think all levels of government need to cooperate together. You know, one size doesn't fit all. But locally, those business leaders in those local communities know what's holding them back and what they need to see happen. And they don't need someone telling them what to do. Like, just, you know, give them the ability to kind of go out there and innovate and make it happen so we can hold on to our young people.
The next thing I'm going to ask you about, from the way things are looking, will be decided on a federal level more so than on a local level. That wasn't the way it looked like at first. I don't even have to say much. All I have to ask you is the bathroom law.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, I don't discriminate against anybody. You know, coming from a military background, we always were able to make that that distinction not a non-issue. And so for me, the bathroom law is... It's a little bit untenable. I mean, for me, it's there's a reason, and I understand a lot of a lot of the concerns that people have about equal rights and what have you. But
yeah. And I should be, you know, for, just in case somebody doesn't know what I'm asking about. But it's a, you know, recently with the Obama administration saying that they would support the transgender students choosing which bathroom they would use with the gender that they identify with, and that.
Yes.
The implication that money for schools could be tied into whether or not which way you fall. So now it's become a federal issue. That's why I'm asking.
I understand. And I think it's wrong for them. I don't think anybody's ever had any money withheld. And I know this is a new development. This is a new wrinkle. I don't think anybody's ever had money withheld. But just the threat of doing that, that's an untenable situation. That's, you know, really forcing people to deal with things that they're probably not prepared to deal with. I think... Over time, if you could look back, I'm sure there's all kinds of examples. Transgender people have already been doing all of these things, you know, going to the bathroom that they identified with, not the one that the sex that they were born with. But, you know, these things are incremental. I mean, these social changes come over time, and I think it'll probably work itself out. But it's not going to be something instantaneous. And to try to force those kinds of changes in short order is what's got everybody all upset, you know. And so for me, it's like, you know, it says boys' bathroom, the boys should go there and the girls should go in the girls' bathroom. And now some people are saying, well, we should just have bathroom, you know, and you decide you go in there and you're going to have compartments. And we're certainly, you know, these are all going to be mandated. Like, who's going to pay for all of this? You know, and so the threat of withholding federal funds is, I think that's untenable. I hope that doesn't affect you know, what we want to see happen, you know, over time. I think incrementally, and I know if someone was a transgender person, it's like, I want to be able to do this now. I think most people understand and are sympathetic. I'm not so sure. I'm not sure that I know a transgender person. If they wanted me to know, I think I would know, but I don't think I do know. And I'm sensitive to their concerns and to their needs, but there's a, and that's the whole idea about being in a republic. I mean, you want to make sure that, you know, we don't have all these quick decisions that are contrary to the best interests of all people. And so I think it's going to take time to kind of sort this out, but it's certainly going to be a hot potato. Obviously, the Justice Department's getting involved, taking on the North Carolina case. And so we're all kind of going to wait and see how that all plays out. Hopefully it doesn't cause any harm to anybody or any institution, for that matter, in a way that that we can't live with and work with in advance. And I can tell you, you know, from a military perspective, we've done all these social experiments, you know, with integrating the forces. I mean, now we have women that can go into combat units. I mean, there's all kinds of change that happens over time, but it's kind of incremental. We've got women doing, matter of fact, the big debate about women being in combat units. Well, I was a military police commander. You know, we had women in our units since the beginning of time, you know, doing that kind of work. And many of them were in combat as well.
You have women now being required to register for the draft, or that's coming up. And what do you feel about that?
Well, I tell you, I mean, this is all about, you know, equity and equality. I'm for that. So if we're going to do that, then no holds barred. Everybody should register for the draft. And there's always exceptions, even in the draft. Before we start talking about drafting women, if you got poor health, there's exemptions. And so I say, if we're going to have equality in the all branches of the service, then everybody should be eligible for the draft. And so it's just a register. We don't draft. We have an all-volunteer military. But it's just a register to know who's who and where they're at. And if they've got reasons not to serve, conscientious objector or whatever, you know, you declare that, and it'll work itself out. Now, I think Rick, they just took that out of some legislation, so that's going to be, they're going to kick the can down the road on that question.
Well, there was quite a firestorm with it, so that's absolutely where, you know, I was wondering where you would.
Let me tell you, I've served with some great people throughout my military career, and key, you know, if we keep doing the same things, we're going to get the same results. And I just got to tell you that I've had some great female officers and enlisted people doing phenomenal thing. So I have all the trust and confidence if they have the desire to serve in those kinds of roles. And even guys, like to be a ranger or whatever, I mean, not everybody can do that. And we just graduated the first two or three females through the ranger school. And so if they can do it, you know, then they get to do it.
We'll stick with veterans for the last 2 minutes here, because with all of the effort to try to improve veterans care services up here, the recent report just coming out this week is that, you know, waits at the VA are now longer than ever. That, you know, after all of this effort to clean things up, it's going in the wrong direction. So what would you do differently?
Well, you know, this goes back to, you know, the veteran service organizations have a really good feel. So I'm a Vietnam veteran, so that's as far as I go back. But there's Korean veterans, and there's still some World War II veterans. And over time, as the number of veterans was diminished, you know, the amount of money to run the VA went down correspondingly. But then we had, Iraq and Afghanistan, and we got all these new veterans. So there's more demand that could fit through the pipeline. And so they've worked to fix that. Now we've got all kinds of options for veterans to go in their local community if they live too far away from a VA hospital. And so what's really happening is that's working. And so now more people like, you know, I don't want to go to Saginaw, but if I can go to Grayling or Traverse City or Escanaba, I'll go. And so now they're signing up. And so now it looks like, you know, there's an inordinate number of, there's more demand than there is resources to do it. And so I give Secretary McDonald a great vote of confidence. He's bringing some business savvy to the VA. It's a very large bureaucratic health system by design in the beginning because of corruption. So there's all these checks and balances, very bureaucratic. And so for me, if someone I've done this as sheriff. I've done this as a community leader. I've done this as a military person. If somebody has served our country in uniform, they have a special place in my heart, and I'm interested in solving those problems.
Jerry, if someone wants to be able to follow your campaign, how can they do that?
Well, you know, we had a really bad accident back in December and sort of put us sidetracked, but we're in recovery mode now and getting mobile. But we have a website, www.cannon4congress.com. And then, we're on Facebook. So we're pretty easy to find. And, we're making the rounds. We're getting around the district kind of at a hectic pace, trying to get back up to full speed. But someone can give me a call, if they think there's something important they like to know about me or know where I stand, just give me a call. We'll get back with you right away.
Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Hey, Rick, thanks for the interest. Appreciate the opportunity.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.